Definitely physics there. I tried to contact you before, you couldn't hear me because I was on a 5-watt setting, which I make the KCRC machine real easy with that, so I had to get out the manual for this radio. It's embarrassing to say, I don't know how to use my own radio. I had to look up how to adjust the power level, but I'll be on the side here.
Okay, very good. Yes, this repeater is further over to the Queens Long Island border. So that's probably why you need a little bit more juice to capture it. So feel free, if you have any questions coming up later, to let us have them. But we thank you for showing up and participating in this very, very interesting experience. Anyone else have any questions, comments, statements for the technical net? If not, I'll do one of my little Socratic questions and hopefully find someone to answer them, and maybe we'll learn a few things. So, but before then, any other questions out there? Okay, let's move on to the Socratic moment. Now, I hope I have a brave person out there, and up front, I do not bite, I do not yell, and I appreciate anyone who participates in these little Socratic chats about things. My question tonight is actually was answered before on the technical net, and so some of you may remember Dick's answer, and I hope to expand upon it as well. It's one of the first questions I ever asked in science when I was a little kid. I looked up in the sky and I said, why is the sky blue? So is there anyone out there who has a good reason why, of all the colors in the rainbow, the sky seems to be blue?
KC2, WTA.
Yes, Joe.
I think it's... does it have something to do with the width of the air molecule? I think I heard years ago that the width of the air molecule corresponds roughly to the wavelength of blue light.
Well, it's close to that, but it's not quite that specific. There's something about our atmosphere. Pretty much almost any atmosphere in general, unless it introduces some strange factor in and of itself, that leads to this coloration of the sky to be blue. It's not exactly as fine-tuned as the particular molecules or atoms. And some people have kind of suggested that in the past, but experiments show that it's not as special as that. Any other brave soul want to make a suggestion of what might be going on?
KE2KB.
Yes, KE2KB, go ahead.
This is KE2KB, name is Frank. Is something to do with the scattering of the blue light, that the atmosphere scatters the blue but passes all the other colors?
Yes, you remember it correctly. There is a phenomena that goes by the name of Rayleigh scattering, named after a physicist whose last name was Rayleigh, that indicates that electromagnetic waves scatter more as their wavelength decreases or their frequency increases, which is two ways of saying the exact same thing. So red light scatters through the atmosphere the least, which you see during dusk and dawn. During dusk and dawn, the sun is the farthest away, cutting through the atmosphere the most, scattering the blue and other colors and giving you that lovely red aura that's being scattered the least. And by completely reverse logic, blue is a very short frequency light and scatters, and so when you look at the sky, you see blue.
on the dock.
Yes, Wesley.
It just popped to my mind, if I'm not going side of the subject discussed. The higher is the frequency or the wavelength of the lightning beam, the more energy photon has, the more ionization it does. As a matter of fact, there is something that is being called electrolaser. And this one is used as a direct energy weapon. But what I'm trying to say is that laser induced plasma channel, a laser is also the form by a laser beam in the air. So that laser beam rapidly heats and ionizes surrounding gases from the plasma that actually corresponds with the subject that we spoke before.
Yes, if you wish to emit a electromagnetic wave in the ionizing range, which is above visible light, ultraviolet and above, you can ionize the atmosphere and you can give a lightning someplace better suited to go. I don't know if anyone really does much of that. I think the problem is that there aren't that many ultraviolet lasers out there, and there certainly aren't any gamma ray lasers, so I think it's more of a theoretical construct than a practical ploy.
Not necessarily. The higher we go, then we're reaching the lower X-rays, which are photons as well, and then we go into higher ones, and then we go into gammas. And gammas was where we started our original discussion from. So we either have the ionization of the air and creation of the path through the particles, which would be the alpha particles, or through the photons. And to explain.
Yeah, okay, but once again, you're kind of stuck with marketing problems. If you're going to start emitting high-energy ionizing radiation into the sky, where there are airplanes flying around, you are going to bump into a lot of people who are unhappy with you.
Absolutely right. Yeah. Absolutely right. Although it's direct, although it's thin, although it's ionizing, I wonder, wouldn't that be the best way to attract lightning and discharge it to save the property? It doesn't have to belong. I'm just theorizing.
Understand and I appreciate it, but the first time that anyone comes up with any mutagenic disorder, lymphoma, leukemia, lung cancer, what have you, even if they smoked 8 packs a day, and they took a plane within 500 miles of your lightning machine, you're going to get your backside sued out from under you.
What kind of plasma is being produced every day, zillions times per minute, by all of the lasers around? Nobody complains?
Well, those are in enclosed spaces in laboratories that people don't even know about and so don't care about. You start pointing it out into planes and such on the outside, they'll start to be interested.
Good point. Thank you very much.
WS2N, on the sky.
Cool.
You look at the horizon when it's, you know, sunrise or sunset, and it's reddish, pinkish, and then if the sun is above you, the sky is blue. So you're saying it's the density of the air. In other words, if we suddenly we increase the density of our air and we multiply it, you know, that by the same distance, if you look to the horizon, it would probably be about, you know, four times the
distance, instead of, let's say, having a 60-mile high atmosphere, now you've quadrupled that. Would the sky then look pinkish red, and at 12 o'clock in the afternoon instead of blue? I also had to do with the makeup of the atmosphere, the nitrogen and oxygen percentage, that type of thing. Back to you, Roy.
It isn't that as you increase the concentration of particulates and increase the scatter, you shift the spectrum. By the nature of Rayleigh scattering, the shorter the wavelength, the more the scatter. The difference with the redness of the sun rising up in dawn and dusk is scatter is not a directional phenomenon. So the directional light that the sun gives you is experiencing the most amount of scatter in other directions of the blueness of it. It's scattering red the least, and so red is the thing that penetrates directionally at you, and you recognize the image as a red-tinged sun. The Rayleigh effect will cause the general atmosphere all around you to look that bluish hue, because it scatters it in all directions, as opposed to direct red light that scatters the least and gives you that discoloration. It's less obvious when the sun is up in the sky because it's going through a smaller length of atmosphere. As it reaches dusk and dawn, it's tangential and cuts through a much longer path of particulates within it, which scatter the blue and only leave you the red sun.
Very good. Very good. And I used to hear the theories of the water was blue, and that's the reason the sky was blue. Or the water was blue because the sky was blue. But of course, this is a much better scientific description of what's going on with the scattering of the rays. Very good. Back to you, Roy.
Well, there's always a reason, and within the reason is another reason, and within the reason is another reason. It's like layers of an onion. So let me peel away this level of the onion, which has been discussed by Dick on the TechNet. I've listened to it, and I've been told it when I was a young man. And let me add an unfortunate complication to this entire discussion, which is that the visible spectrum, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet. Blue doesn't have the shortest wavelength of visible light. So I then ask you the question of if what's going on principally is Rayleigh scattering of short wavelength light, why the heck isn't the sky purple?
I thought that had to do with the oxygen and nitrogen content.
No, there's actually a completely egocentric reason for the results. I wonder if anyone else out there would hazard a guess of why, when we look out in the sky, we really don't see much in the way of purple.
The only time I see it is with the rainbow. You take a hose and shoot it away from the sun, and you'll still see purple when you make your rainbow.
It's quite true, and occasionally people will use the answer that the sun really doesn't have much in the way of purple, and the fact that you see it in the rainbow demonstrates that that's not a good reason. So it hints at the actual underlying, very, very human reason why we see a blue sky. So there's got to be some guy who's very adventurous who would like to kind of come up to the radio and give his 2 cents worth. We don't bite.
AC2LR, I'm your guy.
Okay, I'm glad you pushed the talk button. So do you have the solution to my little inquiry?
Scattered as much or more than the blue. When we look at the sky, our cones are telling our brain that we see blue, even though there is violet there. Okay, Emma Handel K, call sign AC2LR.
We'll say, Kay, you are incredibly close to the answer, but let's hear what Wes has to say and we'll get back to you.
Yeah, I was a little away, and I've heard that you're talking about the color of the sky. So I might be not in the sun. Well, the sky is blue because blue light in the sun rays bends more than the red light. But this extra bending or scattering applies just as much as the violet light. So it is reasonable to ask why the sky isn't purple. Was it the question?
Yes, that is the question in a nutshell, Wes.
Our eyes perceive the spectrum. And they perceive the spectrum this way, not the other way. And the next problem is scattering of the sunlight. More for shorter wavelengths than for longer ones. And thank you.
Hey Wes, but that doesn't exactly explain it. That kind of points you in the general direction, but do you have any further details about that? How your eye sees it? Why is that how your eye sees it?
There is a common prism reveals sunlight in its midst of the colors of the rainbow. So when the light from the sun enters the Earth's atmosphere, it is scattered or reflected by molecules in the atmosphere, and that will be primarily the nitrogen and oxygen. Then we have a shorter wavelength, blue and violet, that are scattered more than the longer wavelengths, red and yellow. So as we look in the direction of the sky away from the sun, we see those wavelengths that are bent the most. Yeah, I could add about the complex spectrum, different wavelengths. There is a radian between 400 nanometers, which is violet, and violet, and 450 nanometers, which is the blue. And that would relate to the how our eye see the color. That is 380 to 740 nanometers.
Hey Wes, you see, you went from vague to ultra-specific of discussing the wavelength. So let me put it back in the middle, approximately where Kay placed it. And like I said before, Kay, you were close by nanometers. The trick is we're talking not about science, unfortunately, but we're talking about humans and human perceptions. And humans cut a lot of corners physiologically to get the most bang for the buck, if you will. Insects have four color detectors in their rods, cones. And mammals, unfortunately, for the most part, have two. Primates, monkeys, chimpanzees, gorillas, and us, we picked up another, so we're trichromic, except for the poor guys and gals who are colorblind. But there's a little bit tricky of how we perceive color. Let me drop. We have three detectors. We have a red detector, we have a green detector, we have a blue detector. Now that sort of gives you a little problem in that purple is a visible color. If you have a blue detector, how does it tell the difference between blue and violet? Because That's what the detector is. There's no violet detector. Now, insects, a lot of insects have violet detectors, and that's why if you shine ultraviolet light on butterflies and such, you get these beautiful patterns, because they see things that we never see. The trick our retina works at is it samples the green. All of our receptors have a wide bandwidth of different strengths that it picks up different frequencies around the center frequency of blue, green, and red. The trick with blue is if it sees a little bit of green in the blue, it sends a signal to your brain that you're looking at blue. If it sees absolutely no green in that color, it sends you a signal that you're looking at purple. The problem you get is if you mix blue and purple together, because your reception signals get completely confused, it picks up the slight green detection of the blue dye, and it reads it totally as sky blue. So, in fact, the sky is purple, and we just don't recognize it. We can't perceive purple when we mix it with the color blue, unless it's a lot of purple and very little blue. So that's the big question of why the sky is blue. The answer ultimately is... Free to add something, Wesley.
Yeah, when I said about 280 to 740 nanometers for an eye, that would be sensitivity of the human eye to the light. And I was just recently, because of one of my equipments that I have for night vision, looking at the material available. The typical retina are 10 million rods for sensing low light levels, as 5 million cones for detecting color vision drop. So each cone contains pigment that restricts range of wavelengths that the cone responds to. So there are three varieties of cones for long, medium, and short wavelengths. It's like an antenna, actually. As we know, light is electromagnetic wave. Eye is your receiver of electromagnetic waves that does not differ in the mechanics of receiving the electromagnetic signal from any other antenna or any other structure. The only that is differently made, let me jump. So you need three of the wavelengths to see the colors correctly. And the three colors in different grade of that color give us all of the gamma of those colors. The peak response for the long cones is 570 nanometers, which would be yellow. Minimum would be green, that would be 543 nanometers. And the violet and blue would be 442 nanometers. And those three overlapping one over the other is like the pattern that we're doing when we trying to paint something on the cone on the paper. And so it's here.
Okay, Wes, I agree with you. You're talking about human color perception of people who aren't colorblind. People who are colorblind, unfortunately, have a genetic defect in one of their color receptors. But the average human being, the average chimpanzee, and the average gorilla are trichromic vision. Most mammals are not trichromic. Your dog, those bulls that rear their head at red flags, they really don't give a damn about it being red. It's that some guy is you know, waggling that big piece of cloth in their face that really upsets them. So most mammals tend to be colorblind, and most insects have far better vision than we have with four color receptors. You know, they can see ultraviolet patterns, all manner of things. So, yeah, you're correct, but I was trying to kind of give an impression that things we sort of take for granted aren't really real, which I always find fascinating. And, Kate, like I said before, you pretty much came closest. You know, I'm a stickler on details, but otherwise you had exactly the right idea. It's visual reception.
If we look at the build of an eye and those conics respond, I'm not sure. You got to correct me. You are the doctor. I think that has to do something with neural signal communication with an eye and brain function. But there is some tweaks that makes red and green turn into the yellow, and that is happening in the sky. So the sky combination of violet and blue, Alex, the same cone response for the pure blue plus white light, which is equal to mixture of the colors. You know better.
Yes. The point is that life, as I said before, cuts a lot of corners. It's very, very difficult to genetically sequence dyes that run across the entire color spectrum for every little pixel in the retina, for your image. And so it plays little games. It's realized that if you get three broadband color receptors, red, green, and blue, you can do all the mechanics back in the back of your occiput of your brain, the visual cortex, and integrate the red, green, and blue amplitude signals into all the colors of the rainbow. And that's why LEDs and fluorescent lights don't really shine all the colors in the rainbow. If you take a prism and break out the actual colors, you'll only find three or four different colors in the spectrum. But it's enough to trick us, and since we're the people paying the money, not the butterflies, then you get these kind of little tricks. And yes, if our receptor is triggered for green and red, our brain says the thing is yellow if it's high enough. If the amplitude signal is too low, we start to perceive it as being brown. You know, there are colors out there that are not actually frequencies. Pink is not a particular frequency. Pink is red with a lot of green and blue added to just increase the overall intensity from all of the three photoreceptors. So there's a lot of colors that we see in our brain. And every so often I wonder if what I call green is the same thing that you or someone else calls green. Because there's no way of checking what colors look like in people's heads.
I think the difference between the complex spectrum and the one that is mixture of pure blue and white is kind of impossible for the brain, or the typical brain, to process for an eye that is receiving those signals. That means eye cannot tell the difference and direction.
Yes, I agree entirely. AC2, GS, by the way. I agree entirely that, as I said before, we cut corners evolutionarily to maximize our survivability. So we're optimized for the world that we live in. Since the world doesn't really function on a quantum mechanical stage, we aren't quite that comfortable with quantum mechanics or relativity or all these other things. But in the macro world that our generations before us have lived and died and been born again, it's been optimized. And so we have skills built into us. We have a kind of built-in physics. Mechanics is kind of second nature to, if we throw a ball, we sort of know where it's going to go. Not because we studied the Newton, but because we're kind of wired for that. Because if you have animals that don't know where things are going to fall, they usually don't last very long. So we do cut corners, and it can be tricked. That's what all these optical illusions are about, are very subtle ways of tricking your visual cortex into seeing things that aren't really there.
In nature is, how do you call it, you have a desert, and then on the desert you see the object that they are not there, just reflected object. It looks like reality. It's not a phantom, it's a mirage. What is the English word for it?
The English English word as well. We stole it from the French, mirage. It's basically just a trick of light refraction from a heated layer of atmosphere.
Now, interesting is a question for you. Perception. The human brain is able to create in an eye a tri-dimensional image of something that is just created by reflected photons and see and it courses cows of houses. They don't exist. They exist 100 miles up there. And to exchange.
Yes. Well, in a way, we are helped by having binaural vision. It's a little bit easier to project the three-dimensional reality if you have two images that are slightly off-center. And so the parallax differences can be correlated in your occipital cortex, your visual cortex, and give you a lot of information of the distance away you are, and then it pulls out the relative size of the items that you're recognizing and factors that in to the equation. And once again, we do all kinds of tricks because it makes it more likely for us to survive if we can maneuver in three-dimensional space, even though our visual cortex really gives us primarily two-dimensional information. Parallax helps, but even a guy with an eye patch can sort of figure out what's going on in three-dimensional space with just one eye. So it's sort of amazing what your brain can do. Your brain is designed for all manner of things. It does a lot of very interesting sound processing. When you're in a cocktail party and there's 15 conversations going on, you can actually focus on one conversation and lessen the gibbering of the noise background from the other people. And that's all done at the level of your auditory center in your brain. So, be kind to your brain. Don't do anything bad to it. But it's very, very useful.
My question, are you able to totally switch off, concentrate on something that you're doing despite the ambient noise that is very much disturbing to others?
People can, some people can't. It's a combination, I think, of genetics and training and motivation. I have a very unique ability that confused neurologists when I demonstrated it. I have a little bit of a lazy eye. And so, since childhood, I've been able to actually turn off an eye. I can shift complete control to my right eye or my left eye or fuse the two images together. Most people don't really practice that, and so they don't have that innate ability or they can't access it. I can for some strange reason. And there are other people with their own little interesting ways of controlling functions that we sort of take for granted as being autopilot.
Yeah, it's interesting. I never tried it. But I can switch off. I know that the ambient noise is there. I just don't hear it. I hear it. I know it's there. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't matter how loud it is. Coming back to mirages, there are two categories, inferior and superior. The superior is called Fata Morgana, and inferior is meaning lower. I'm just reading. I didn't train my English in that subject. Let me just. I just got to Wikipedia. And it says about the contrast to a hallucination. A mirage is a real optical phenomenon that can be captured on a camera. So it is not only that it is our eyes and our brain that is processing, but actually we take that image taken on a camera. We would see that mirage as well. And to
it's not a thing that's going on in your brain, as I think I mentioned. It has to do with a local temperature shift that changes the refractive index of the atmosphere just above the ground, which causes light to bend in an unusual way. And when we see that light bending in an unusual way, we draw an obvious conclusion and see a mirage. And if you point a camera, it just follows the same general rule and establishes an image similar. But it's you're not seeing a real thing, you're seeing a refracted image going through a heated layer of air.
I'm reading here, for exiled travelers in the desert, the interior in mirage may appear to be lake of the water in the distance. An inferior mirage is called inferior because the mirage is located on the real object. The real object is inferior mirage. Say the blue sky on any distance, therefore bluish object in the same direction. The mirage causes the observer to see bright and bluish pups on the ground in the distance. And there is a nice picture on the Wikipedia showing on Mojave Desert the lake with some kind of ramp for the boats and to exit.
As the hot air circulates, it causes a visual rippling in the image, and we're not quite used to transmitted images rippling. We're used to objects ripple and reflect back at us at a somewhat constant transmission medium of air. And so again, we put two and two together and we come up with 22, because what's really happening is what we're taking as a transparent medium is introducing a shimmer effect that's very similar to the way that water kind of sparkles at you.
I agree with that. We have a similar situation when we're driving in on the road, on the highway, and the horizon, we see the hot air. We should not be able to see air, but then we see about the density of the medium. But the density of the medium is actually the mechanism behind the inferior mirage, which would be the very much unstable layer of the cooler air and hotter air at the horizon and direction.
The temperature of atmosphere provides an optical index of refraction. If it's uniform, the refraction is uniform. If there's a gradient of temperature, it's like putting a prism or a lens in its place, which we're not used to seeing naturally formed thermal lenses, if you will. But the closest kind of way I could describe it without any technical terms is it's a lens-like aphorism that occurs because of a differential temperature across the atmosphere.
The other question is, do we then dealing with superior mirage, which would be air below the line of sight, is colder than the air above, and that agreement is called temperature intervision, since the warm air above cold air is opposite of the normal temperature gradient of the atmosphere, then the passing through the temperature inversion, the light rays bend down, and so the image appears above the true object. And to exit.
Yes, temperature inversion, which also, getting back to amateur radio, is the mechanism that ducting propagation occurs. If you have thermal inversions of a layer, usually over a large water mass, that allows guys in California to work UHF and VHF all the way to Hawaii. So these things occur on the radio frequencies as well as they do on the visible light frequencies. It's a very interesting phenomenon.
I wonder if there are some guys who are specializing in polar communication where the superiors realize or this kind of phenomena is pretty much present in polar regions. I'm wondering if anybody else has something to add. And Tricia.
I will certainly open it up to the participants of this technical net. I am not aware of too many people in Long Island and New York having traveled to those particular planes, but I will open it up for anyone who wants to make any kind of a comment or a statement or a question on any of the stuff that I've been saying for the last 45 minutes or so.
Looks like somebody's responding, but the common point to ham radio, whether we're talking about Fata Morgana or which is one of the types of mirage, and we're talking about electromagnetic waves, we're talking about photons and photons paths and photons traveling. Even though that we were talking about lightning strikes, we were talking about photons as well. And we're talking about electromagnetic waves. So we're still on the subject. Patricia.
This is ultimately the amateur radio technical net. So everything comes back to electromagnetism one way or the other.
Okay, I think I've got all the question and answers, Dr. Roy, my friend, for tonight. I don't want to go to heavy stuff, because everybody's going to be bored. Thank you for the opportunity. And to you.
AC2GKJ, late check-in, listening.
Welcome to the group. Do you have any comments, or you just wanted to let us know you were here?
Letting them know you're here and just listening and learning, and like the gentleman said, I don't want to get too complex. I think you're already there.
We're not going to get any more complex tonight, hopefully. I just wanted to leave people with the impression that what we all tend to take for granted isn't necessarily so. That's all that the point of this was. Now, it came to my mind because recently I've been reading a biography of Leonardo da Vinci, and in one of his many books he scribbled his opinion of why the sky was blue, and he got it wrong, but then, you know, he comes from a couple of centuries ago, so he didn't have the benefit of the internet, so we excuse him for that. He also had another question in his book that I'll throw out to you guys before we go to the space report. We all know that there are lenses in our eyes because people complain about cataracts and such, and so we sort of know inherently that there's a convex lens that sits there in our pupil and directs the light towards the back of our retina. Now, I ask for the general audience of if you've ever kind of played with a lens, it seems to do a strange thing. It tends to invert the image. So why aren't we perpetually looking around upside down? Any ideas out there?
That's the SLR camera, right? Is that what that means, too?
SLR for single lens reflex. It has what's called a pentascopic prism, which reflects light back down sideways all around and finally emits it at the viewfinder right side up. So unfortunately, we don't have a pentaflex prism in our eyeballs to do that correction for us.
Copy. And one other thing before you move to the next subject, you're talking about eyes and vision. Do horses see things larger?
Well, having never actually communicated with a horse, I can't definitively tell you. But I can only assume that there is nothing that would mean that they would see things particularly any other size than we would. The distance between their eyes are farther apart and are less forward than ours. So their three-dimensional vision probably is not quite as good as animals that have flat faces with eyeballs pointing straight out. But I don't think there's any particular difference in size differential. Again, they were forced on an evolutionary basis to find food and such, so their vision has to be able to find the things that they have to find. And if it failed them and they gave miscues of different sizes than reality, they would end up reproducing at a lower level and have problems.
Maybe that's a mess. All right, thanks, KC2DKJ. We're in Amityville. Name is Bob. WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I'm back on your question about reversing the image. I would say it is reversed in our retina, you know, where it's being formed. So I think the brain is automatically reversing it. That's my guess. And I heard Kay in there again, AC2LR. Back to you.
Hey, Kay, do you have something to say?
Yes, this is AC2LR. I agree with Paul. The brain compensates for the upside-down image and describes it to us as right side up.
Again, absolutely positively correct. Now, question number two of this part. If I somehow had you fitted for a pair of prism lenses and rotated your image again, what would your brain do with that information? Would you spend the rest of your life, as long as you wore those glasses, banging into things, or would something strange happen to you?
The brain continues to compensate. So it will, to some, let's see, because I know the experiments with the cats, when they had kittens fitted with vertical, like Venetian blind eyeglass lenses, they could only see, they developed vertical stripe vision. They couldn't see horizontal stripes. And when you took the glasses off of them, they would bump into things that were horizontal, like a tabletop, because they... So I think there's a developmental stage when your brain realizes it can compensate for anything it's seeing. And if you go through that developmental stage properly, your eyes will continue to compensate throughout your life for any adjustment that you see in your visual field. Is that close?
AC2GS. Yes, it's very, very close. There are different... The brain is very plastic when babies are born, and a lot of it really isn't developed correctly because it requires feedback stimulus. And the amount of nerve cells are much greater for a infant than they are for an adult. So a whole lines of cells die off, connections form and reform. And vision is one of those things that if you do not give the proper stimulus to a child before a certain age, you cause them to have a lifelong problem. Take for me the lazy eye. Because I had the lazy eye, my brain kind of developed this two-switch mechanism that usually doesn't develop. With reverse images, the funny thing is, and they've done this repeatedly because it amuses a lot of people, if you were to wear a prism, immediately your image would be inverted. And if you wore it all day and went to sleep with it and got up the next day, it would be inverted. But there would be a time period after 4 or 5 days that you would get up, look through your prism lenses, and see the normal world that you always see with the prism lenses on. Now, the downside is if you then take the prism lenses off, surprise, surprise, the world is flipped upside down again for a few days. So we have an actual mechanism somewhere in our brain that takes time to flip images. It's not hardwired, it's softwired. So it's kind of interesting how many controls are softwired in our brain that, again, we take for granted.
AC2LR.
Yes, Kay.
I have a quick personal story validating that. When I was a kid, our family drove to Florida for a summer vacation in a station wagon, and on the way home, the way that I was just forced to sit with all my brothers and luggage and stuff was I had to sit at the back of the station wagon looking out the back window. And I spent about 8 hours watching the world go away from me as I'm watching, you know, we're passing by things, and so everything, the landscape was moving away from me. When I got out of the car and started to walk up the driveway when we got home, it looked as if the world was rushing at me, and my brain was compensating. Maybe for the next hour or two, I went to sleep, and then I woke up, and everything was normal. But just after 8 hours of watching everything rush away from the back window of the station wagon, my brain already was compensating. So it was a real trippy experience.
Well, that's a great story, and you know, it's another indication of how very plastic our brains are that we don't give them the proper credit. And, you know, the more you kind of look into cognitive science, the stranger our brain becomes. They have ways of detecting when a brain makes a decision to do something. You know, I'm going to pick up the pencil now. And they've timed it, and there's something like a 300 millisecond gap between the time that your body has decided, for all intents and purposes, to pick up that pencil, and your conscious mind is aware of it. And your conscious mind kind of fills in gaps and rationalizes sometimes. And that's the kind of nature of the subconscious mind. There's a whole bunch of stuff going on in the background that's not very obvious to the driver. And, you know, it's kind of amazing to me personally. Oh, well, so I hope that you've enjoyed our little cognitive neurophysiology hour. Not quite the same as last week's special relativity, but a different field entirely. So you got to rest your special relativity muscles. So I hope that you've enjoyed our little discussion today. Once again, for any mailbag questions, we don't seem to get any mailbag questions these days, but in case you have any, the email address is tech@limarktech.net. Again, tech@limarktech.net. And give me your questions, be they amateur radio, physics, chemistry, biology, neurology, anyology out there. And we'll try and do something with them. So it's coming up to 10 o'clock, and I don't want to miss the space report. So next on our calendar is Paul NS2N with the space report. Take it, Paul.
WS2N, very good, Roy. And we did a space report last week. I tried to do a review of the whole year, but that's kind of difficult because there was like 90 rockets worldwide that took off, and probably would cover about maybe 30% of them on this net, and of course mostly U.S., but we'll cover the ones from China and India, and even South Korea had a launch 2 years ago. But Japan has launches. Now this year there's probably going to be a lot more than 90. China has really picked up the pace. We have to watch out for them because they're really going strong. They're expected to have 40 launches alone
and they have like four different launch facilities in China, so they can do that. And including a lunar sample return mission they have planned. Let me drop it. But still nobody does it like the United States. Even right now, as we speak, we still have 8 astronauts flying overhead on the International Space Station. And that's going to stay like that until probably late February or early March when the next crew comes back down. And then they'll have 3. And then I think March 10th or 11th or so, we'll launch 3 more people from Kazakhstan to the International Space Station to bring that group up to 6 again. Hopefully within about a year or so, probably 2019, they'll have a regular four-person crew going up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
They'll have one NASA astronaut, probably somebody from Boeing. I heard a station in there, but a little low. You want to give me a call? Try again. Okay, nothing heard. So like I said, there are a lot of launches. In the United States, we've started launching rockets already. SpaceX, right off the bat, they had one. And now, just Friday, United Launch Alliance launched a big Delta IV rocket from Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. I got to see that live on the computer. It wasn't a NASA flight. It was NRO, National Reconnaissance Orbiter, launch number 47, they call it. And it was a geosynchronous launch. It was very cool to watch, nevertheless. It's not a NASA flight, so you have to go to different websites to watch these things live. In my case, it was spaceflight.com. And you get to see this large 230-foot rocket take off, 2 solids on it, running liquid oxygen and liquid hydrogen for fuel, and the RS-36A engines that they use. That's an impressive vehicle. It's not reusable. That's the newest thing that's come about because of SpaceX. And other people are trying to get on the reusability bandwagon. This is WS2N. Even Europe is thinking about it. Germany and France are getting together to build the Callisto rocket, which will be reusable. Very small compared to what SpaceX is doing, but still a step in the right direction. India plans on building a spacecraft that won't be reusable, but at least they're building a space plane. Probably about maybe 6-7 years down the road, they'll have that. So countries that you don't even think much of compared to what we do in the United States are starting to pick up on the technology, and before you know it. Maybe 10 years down the road, we won't even be able to track it. We'll have to keep track of all these different launches that are going on. Blue Origin. Blue Origin is owned by Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon products. One of the richest guys in the world. He has Blue Origin. He's building a rocket in Florida. New Glenn, and probably by the end of 2019, they expect to test fire that rocket, and that will, he's also building a spacecraft to go with that, which he plans on having the whole first stage also being reusable. duplicating what Elon Musk is doing with the SpaceX program. Elon Musk rockets take off, and sometimes they land on a barge either in the Atlantic or the Pacific, depending on where they take off from. Or they'll go back to land.